Hello, and welcome again to Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with ShoshimWorks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. We have an incredible session here for you today. We're excited to get into it. Anna, thank you for joining. And why don't you share a little bit of an introduction about yourself and the session that we have in front of us today?
Thank you. Well, I think today is really about welcoming our listeners and just acknowledging that this is today we have somebody who's really brought more and more people, more of that inquiring spirit, scientists and entrepreneurs together to really look at an important area of technology. We look at all areas of technology in many of the funding agencies we represent, and that includes space technology, and both within space technology, that includes UAPs and anomalous phenomena. Also worth mentioning that anomalous phenomena appear to be a convergent phenomena. So it's something that even if you're not in space technology, it touches upon bio, advanced materials, energy, propulsion, communications, so many, many areas. And Gary Nolan here today really has eminence both in the UAP field and then a number of those other fields like technology, including biotechnology. So Gary, I'd like you to you've got such an extraordinary background that you should really give your own introduction, but please do tell us the amazing things you've done. And just in recognition that you're exceptionally well-respected by your colleagues in the federal government, I've heard so many people say tremendous things about you. I know you're a leader in the private sector as well, and you've had breakthroughs in so many different fields. So I think the point is, when somebody is leading and has grown and sold many companies that are both impactful with health solutions and then at high valuations, your time is valuable, your insights are valuable, and you've chosen to dedicate your time to this topic area. So please do tell us some of those extraordinary things that you've done, both in academia, business, and other areas.
Great. Well, thank you. And hello to your listeners. It's really great to talk about this particular subject, because while some people might use the term fringe to talk about UAP or the technologies that it might represent, to me, the term fringe represents opportunity, and that it's one of the things that has driven my research over really the last 30, 40 years, and the things that we've developed out of my lab has been looking at fringe ideas, but having within ourselves the motivation and understanding that this is, to us, something that we see not as an impossible or risk, but that it's something that we know with sufficient effort will lead to a result. So, for instance, long ago, back when I was just out of grad school, I had developed a technology for a gene transfer using retroviruses. And it took 3 months down to 3 days. And it is now the preeminent manner by which genes are transferred for gene therapy. And it was just something that even, frankly, a Nobel Prize winner told me wouldn't work. And so I said, well, I'm just going to try it because I think it would, and I think it will. And then after I came to Stanford, I came up with other ideas about how to use these retroviruses to do a fast forward of evolution to, rather than make a cell sicker, make a cell better. And so that was the first company that I had, which we took to NASDAQ, called Rigel, which was something that allowed us to basically find targets in cells that would make cells better. I mean, subsequently, going through all of the things that my lab has been involved with, we've started bioinformatics companies that we sold to Roche, which is now their eminent or preeminent bioinformatics computation system within Roche, created systems for analyzing the immune system and down to an extraordinary level of detail. And it's been always about this idea that I don't like the kinds of data that people are collecting at some point in time, because I think it's insufficient and is not able to answer the questions that's required that we know is there. And so people just keep banging their heads against the wall with the same technology. And I said, well, you know what? If we could do this, look at what we could accomplish. So it's that back to that notion of opportunity lost. If we don't go after something, the opportunity will be lost. And so, yeah, I mean, the companies have been involved with cancer research, immune system, autoimmunity, et cetera. And now I've turned my interests to atomic imaging, looking down at the scale of materials, whether they're biological or metal, at the kind of resolution we know we inevitably need. So a term I often use is going after the inevitable, figuring out what it is that is inevitable. Someone's going to get there. Why don't we try to get there? Not first, not because it's a race, but because if I could give that tool to everybody, then everybody would be able to move ahead. And that's been my modus operandi literally for the last 30 or so years. And so when it comes to, for instance, this atomic imaging that I'm talking about, when I think about the subject matter of UAP, if you have an advanced material, and I'm saying alleged, right? Let's say you have
an alleged advanced or an alleged extraterrestrial?
Alleged extraterrestrial or alleged non-human material. So that it's going to be engineered in a manner that humans don't either appreciate the function of, or the manner in which it is created or was created. And so let's say I had a piece of something that came from a non-human intelligence. First of all, if I don't know what the function is, it could be their equivalent of a can opener, or it could be their equivalent of a power source that is infinitely powerful. So absent function, is it a smoking gun if we don't know what it's doing? So the smoking gun will be within the structure of how it is made. Is it made at a level of complexity or resolution or discriminatory structure that we know humans cannot enable, right? We don't have the ability to make something at this level of resolution. And so to me, the ultimate resolution that we require out of something, which is, we call it inhomogeneous. An inhomogeneous material is something like, so the idea is that currently the manners in which we determine atomic structure is using something like what's called crystallography, where you require something in an ordered structure so that you can shoot a beam of electrons or radiation at it so that it scatters in an ordered way. And from the scattering pattern, you can engineer what the structure must have been. But not everything comes as a crystal structure. So the problem is that there's very few techniques out there that allow for us, in fact, there's no techniques out there that allow for us to take nearly any material and determine what its atomic structure is. Not only where the atoms are, but what the bonding structure is between those atoms. So if I had a material that came from an alleged non-human intelligence, if I could, this is again the series of ifs that you need to go through, if I could back engineer what the structure is, and then I can show that this kind of structure is not something that humans can make, then we have the smoking gun, even if we don't have the function. But once you have the structure, you have something which is called the structure-function relationship. Once you have the structure, then you can go to experts in the various areas relative to what that structure is. It's got these kinds of metals or these kinds of atoms here or these kinds of potential electron holes here or there. And you say, well, okay, if you had this, what could it do? Right? And then you say, well, how did they make that? So that's really the objective of this new instrument that we're making, is to be able to back engineer the structure as well as the bonding structure of how the atoms are arranged. Because to me, it's inevitable. We have to know that of all the materials that exist in the world, we know the structure of about 0.001% of them. I mean, we live in a material universe. I think Madonna said that. It's a material world, right? We live in a material world, and we don't even know what it's made of. We have recipes of how to make something. We don't have methods and architecture of how to make it. And a perfect example of that is the recent claim for a superconductor out of South Korea, where they claimed that they had a room temperature superconductor. And then they very openly put out the recipe for how to make it. Nobody else could make it because the recipe needed to be so perfectly followed. It was like a cake. If you didn't bake the cake just the right way, mixing metaphors, the souffle would fall. Right? And so nobody else was able to make what they claimed they could make, but a woman out of, I think it was Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, who was a computational quantum chemist, showed that if they claimed what they thought they made, if they made what they claimed they thought they made, it actually would be a superconductor. So you have this convergence of needs where we're needing to make things that have very, very particular structures to have electronic properties that we think will enable the next revolution.
And Gary, we've also worked with some companies, so happy to put you in touch, that are really active on kind of that orders of magnitude expansion on the materials side. Mm-hmm. So one of them is Matik, but there are others as well where they do that. They can do that high throughput screening. And there's also companies and entities that look at using AI. So yeah. Kind of if you have, whether you have a material or if you have an array of materials. And another thing that we've done with NASA and ISS is start this More Shots on Goal initiative, which is very mm-hmm. much, okay, you're in a constrained environment, so miniaturize and just do so many things to try to increase the throughput. So mm-hmm. to the extent that it's helpful to utilize or merge up with any of those approaches to do a high throughput, fast iteration
right.
on these potentially extraterrestrial origin or otherwise advanced engineering materials. Interesting, by the way, either way, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's an advanced material. If it's off planet, that's amazing. If it's on planet, that's amazing as well.
I mean, I think some of the companies you're alluding to are doing an evolutionary loop where they have a recipe, they make a whole bunch of variants, they test each variant for function, the functional outcome based on the recipe goes into an artificial intelligence program, which tells you what the next iteration should be. What's missing from that loop is reality, you don't know what the structure actually is of what you made. So you first of all don't have the test for whether or not you made what you thought you made, and you don't have the structure of what you made that would greatly inform the AI loop for what the next generation should be of the loop.
Gary, I'm curious what you've described, this new analysis technique, would apply also to this long ago discovered and reanalyzed magnesium bismuth alloy that purportedly was thought to be a terahertz waveguide. Then we get Oak Ridge experts commenting that, oh yes, that's just something that's been done since the 1950s.
Yeah.
The reason I'm citing.
I have pieces of it. I have several pieces of that material from multiple chains of custody. And there was a claim out of Arrow, or from a former director of Arrow, that it was nothing more than a ballistic shield. Well, I have a piece of it. It's so fragile. It would have pulverized the moment it left the shield case, the missile casing, the moment it got shot. So that's off the plate. I actually have an applied physics grad student here at Stanford. He's not my student, but he's actually looking at the materials in other ways. So we'll see. I mean, here's how I think about it. I have a lot of pieces of materials that are claimed to be from here or there, right? And they have chains of custody. I don't just take any rock that somebody sends me in the mail. And so it has a chain of custody associated with it. And then there's a series of tests that you need to go through. to determine, well, first of all, is the structure something that is interesting? And or are the isotope ratios of the material something that show that it would have to have been constructed with particular in a particular way to create those isotopic ratios that are non-terrestrial? Or is it put together in a way that just says, this is not something that we would normally expect to find out of a smelting pot from an iron foundry? So now there's all of these materials, but there's the problem is that you have for each kind of material a set of expected analysis approaches that should be followed through. Each of those analysis steps requires considerable amounts of money. So if you're doing it in your spare time, which is what I'm doing some of this in my spare time, that means it's taking away from my day job in cancer research. So you need the kinds of resources, I think, that the investment community can bring to bear, where they can look at it as a risk profile opportunity cost.
So Gary, as I'm listening to you on that and curious to hear more, I'm also thinking understandable. Well, any individual person has a bandwidth constraints and there's tremendous value to your time and there's limitations. But I'm thinking about both in the potentially extraterrestrial materials space, certainly the things that have good provenance, we want to look at that. But also, not necessarily from an individual standpoint, but from a national type standpoint, we would want to run all of that. Yep. Kind of ultra high throughput. So I'm kind of wondering, and you could do it as a UAP only, or you could do it as an advanced materials in general. Kind of if you have an advanced material, send it in and it doesn't matter the form factor. Maybe there's some sort of fast screening and what types of analysis should we run? So
You need a pipeline and you need a stable pipeline, not a one-off pipeline. So, for instance, I saw some of the early reports out of Oak Ridge and other places on that material. If my graduate student came in and showed me that report, I would kick them out of the laboratory. Because not only was it just a summary of results, it lacked any of the necessary methodology and raw data that any scientist would expect to have access to be able to reproduce at the very least the calculations. And to be able to look at the methods and say, were these appropriate methods that were applied, right? You don't publish conclusions. You publish the data along with the methods, along with your inferences of what you think that data might conclude or allow you to conclude. And so what bothers me about what a lot of these one-off experiments that have been done by Oak Ridge or anybody else is that they don't apply truly the scientific method. Right. They're not bringing the best of class individuals to the table. They're not necessarily even using the best of class analysis systems. I'm not trying to besmirch the people who are doing it. I'm just saying that if you want to come up with a result and represent that you did the experiment, you need to do it by the scientific method. And this means open data and open access to the data.
Yeah. And what I like in any field of disruptive technology is I really think bottlenecks are an issue. So what we find, and it doesn't need to be UAP, it doesn't need to be extraterrestrial. On our most disruptive technologies, it is most common that maybe one expert out of four might think something's possible. I mean, Gary, you talked about people telling you something wasn't possible. You said, well, I'll just see if I can do it. You know, and that's kind of that is the most common experience, the most disruptive, high impact things. It's very rare that a single expert is gonna back it at the beginning, right? Mm-hmm. So the opportunity for multiple types of investors, multiple funding sources, technical experts disagree. So you can have a good technical expert or a bad technical expert, and they can publish or say there's nothing here or there's something here. But the importance of getting those divergent viewpoints and having the bake-off, right? Mm-hmm. So giving let's not have one person touch the rock. Let's have 10 or 20, right? And what are your competing methodologies and hypotheses? Mm-hmm. You know, what happens? What do we have to build off of?
See, I think what's going to be required is some kind of a consortium investment approach that where you would have multiple VCs, each of whom have their own risk profile in inputs and outputs, all put into a common pool with the general goal of saying, we're going to invest in this. And if something comes out of it, we get a piece of the profits and or we get the opportunity to bid on
on rights to follow through for next steps. And so, because the amounts of money required means that you need to have a building full of instruments, each of which could cost between $3 to $5 million. But then it's a pipeline of opportunity. Because, for instance, the stuff that I have, to be quite frank, is somebody else's leftovers. I mean, slag that seems to, that looks like it dropped off of a UAP that people claim. They see this molten material. So what is that? Did they flush the toilet? Is it something that came out of their dishwasher? I don't know. Or is it a result of the propulsion? But it is a it is evidence that is tangible, and the results that I get from it can be reproduced by another scientist. Now let's take a step beyond the materials that I have, some of which are interesting, have really odd isotope ratios. But there are claims to be...
And sorry, Gary, just because some of the folks on the call, so the isotope ratio being interesting, because that's one potential indicator of whether it's on-planet, off-planet, or highly engineered.
Here's just a quick instance. Magnesium has three isotopes. The isotope ratio, so it's magnesium 24, 25, and 26.
Yep.
So roughly speaking, the isotope ratios are 80% for magnesium, 9% of magnesium 24, 9% for magnesium 25, and 11% for magnesium 26, something like that. It's in that range. I can't remember off the top of my head. And pretty much anywhere you look on Earth, if you were to look at magnesium, you would see those same isotopes. Now, they only differ not by the number of protons, but by the number of neutrons. And that gives them a different weight. They're stable isotopes. They're not radioactive. Anywhere on Earth, you go mining for magnesium, that's pretty much what you'll get. Frankly, if you go to Mars or Venus, you'd probably get something very close to that as well. And that has to do with the stellar formation back 4 or 5 billion years ago. And that's just the way it is. Now, one of the materials that I have had two chains of custody, one of which had normal magnesium ratios, and the other, which had wildly out-of-place ratios. And that was done in duplicate, in the same instrument, at the same time, with the same samples. So it wasn't experimental error, but something, so basically I feel confident that the ratios are wrong or off. They're non-terrestrial. So it didn't come from a meteor, because of at least the provenance of how it came, how it was obtained. It was obtained back in like 1950 something. So it was done at a time when people, it was expensive, still expensive. It was done at a time when it was expensive to make isotopes and purify them and then change those ratios. So why would somebody make it? Would be the first question. It's clear
that it was the result of an industrial process. And I
can't... Sorry, Gary, if it's shareable and it's fine if it's not, did it come off a craft or something, or what was that?
It was claimed to be dropped off of a craft in Brazil, Ubatuba, Brazil, and collected on a beach in Ubatuba, Brazil. It's a very famous case. And so it doesn't prove that it's ET, right? But it proves that it was made by somebody for a purpose, or made by something. It was the result of an industrial process.
Okay. Actually, Gary, there's a very good example of that that we only became possible within probably the last 10 years, the necessity, where you take thermal neutrons on a silicon boule and you essentially, by activation, produce a different N or P out of it because of the decay product. If you were to go and look at that boule, or rather look at a wafer that made use of that process, you would find the same thing, where I believe there are three stable isotopes of silicon, and mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, the least, which is the highest neutron, is actually depleted, because that's mm-hmm. the one that went back to phosphorus.
I see. Got it. Understood.
But the point is, it's the imagination. People, you know, say, well, the only thing is, it must not be from here. A better question to ask is, how would one make something
yes.
that adds magnesium with a yeah. different ratio of isotopes? Right.
And Larry's an expert in fusion. I don't know if we introduced him properly at the beginning at NASA Glenn. And he's a long-term 50-year expert on fusion. So isotopes, et cetera. This is kind of his core, one of his core areas.
Seriously, I know where all the bodies are buried in hot fusion.
Not literally for our guests who might misinterpret in this space.
Yeah, we do have a close-minded audience at times. So, I mean, and that's exactly the point, Larry, is getting, I'm not a metallurgist, right? We happen to have an instrument in my lab that we built for biological purposes that can measure metals and can measure them with spatial resolution. But the point of publication and getting the raw data out there with the story is so that other people can look at it and go, what does this mean? Or here's an answer, like what you just offered. And so that's why this hoarding of data by the government is so problematic. Because you can bet that if there are other countries that have similar materials as to what is claimed here in the United States, that they're being a little bit more open about it and moving ahead. And they probably don't even have the stigma associated with it that we do.
Do you want to name some specific countries, Gary? Because I think that wake-up call, China and others. Russia. There's another one Russia.
Iran. They have smart scientists. I respect, I've had scientists from every one of those countries in my lab. And I respect, frankly, the teaching that they have. They get blackboard math taught. We don't get blackboard math taught anymore.
Nope.
And that basic training is missing. And India would be another. I don't consider India an adversary.
Always the same way.
Yeah. And so it's like there's so much potential, and it just hurts my soul when I see it not being used. So,
and Gary, for people who aren't particularly materials curious and are more kind of impact focused, where does this become a product that dominates a market? How does this impact national security? Could you share with us some of the advantages of the material properties that you've seen or that you believe could be achieved?
Well, okay, so let's say that we have an alloy. Okay, so let's talk about these claimed craft. Okay, well, where's the power source? How do they generate a field which seems to allow them to go from 0 to 5,000 miles an hour and not squish everything inside like a bug, right? So is the power source, so one of the things that I often wonder about, is the power source and the field generation separate or contiguous? Are you at the same time extracting the necessary energy from somewhere, but you're using that energy immediately to generate the field? And so, or is there a battery in the center and then there's conduits that create the field outside? Who knows? Right. But what you're looking at, if any of this is true, is thousands of technology revolutions. Understanding even one little piece of what one of those technologies might represent would be, in my opinion, the equivalent of understanding that silicon can be used to make transistors.
Yep.
And doping silicon or germanium in the right way makes a transistor. Our world is dependent on sand and making pure sand and slightly impure sands. And that's
all dirty sand.
Dirty sand. And so imagine if you've got something like that in these pieces of claimed crash retrievals. And to think that people are using those things to try to figure out what the global function of the objects are, as opposed to saying, you know what? We don't try to figure out what the global function of the human body is. We go in and look as biologists, and we're literally, as biologists, we're reverse engineering human biology little by little, piece by piece, because we know we have to get down to the most fine structure of the functionalities of cells, proteins, RNA, etc., to understand how all the pieces come together.
Similarly, if I were in charge, for instance, of a reverse engineering program for UAP, I would have a huge basic science division that did nothing but figure out what the structure of these objects is and create a data library, an Atlas Atomica, whatever you want to call it, of all of these materials. That doesn't mean you don't have somebody who's looking at systems engineering on the other side, yeah. Right? But you know, that's what's required for this, not putting in a warehouse somewhere in a box.
And you know, Gary, to your point, there are models like that. So something that, you know, and some of these, unfortunately, certain programs, the time to funding is not fast because sometimes there are different stage gates in a process. But one example that I can share is at the National Science Foundation, they have IUCRC's Industry University Competitive or Cooperative Research, I forget which. But it's less to point to that program, and it's more to say the overall model is, if something's $20 million, if there's 20 participants that put $1 million in, mm-hmm. then there's your $20 million. They engage in pre-competitive research that everybody can license or leverage to productize after. So that kind of, that model of public and private sector entities getting together in the pre-competitive side definitely does exist. I'm sure there are many more in addition to that program. But you actually can do it really with any... You don't need the government. Maybe I think we might see some of this come out of DeFi and decentralized science, you know, depending mm-hmm. on how, what the, yeah, so appreciate your point there. But the reverse engineering, the basic science, you know, I think getting those materials accessible to in the science more iterative.
And you have to, so here's one of the questions that I think people make a mistake on. People always ask, are they here? Is ET here? Or is some non-human intelligence here? I think that's the wrong question. The right question should start with, can they get here? And if they can get here, how did they do it? Right? Because if you can't answer the question, can they get here, in the affirmative, asking the question, are they here, is meaningless. Right. So you just go back to first principles.
To that point, I think that's a great point, Gary. And I know you're really strong on scientific method, and it could be this, it could be that. So if you want to stay in that lane, I think it's really important. But the other thing that we do want to offer people the opportunity is to say, what do we feel like we know? Right. Because mm-hmm. some people that want to engage in this space, whether they're investors, whether they're scientists, they don't have the same access to whatever it is, hundreds or thousands of conversations and the time that you and others have spent on this. So if we already know, well, we're confident that, yes, like we've got Ryan Graves as a pilot says, it's operational. I saw it every day. Yeah, some of us have seen things, but not every day. So we don't have that same level of authority of, we know this is a thing. Or you can say, I've held the materials and they do X, Y, and Z. So what are some of the things that you would say, believe it or don't believe it, but you can put a stake in the sand and say these things as a primary, or you believe it, what are the types of things that you would put a stake in the sand on?
I would put a stake on the sand is that there are materials that are being held. I mean, I was literally supposed to gain access to one of those sets of materials back around 2014, 2015, until a certain office within the government stepped in and said no. I mean, I literally know the address of where it was being kept. And then it was within a few days after they said no, somebody backed up to it with an 18-wheeler and carted all the stuff off to another place. Now, that's just a story to your audience, but it was a great disappointment to me at the time to feel that we had access to money, that we were going to be given access to these materials, and we could get going. And probably the first more public analysis approach of the materials. So that's a stake in the sand. Now, for most people, it's a story. And they're going to say, oh, well, you were being fooled. They were just gaming your Gary. That's fine. But
others would say there are other sources, right?
So exactly.
It's a disappointment. It's a disappointment to not have access to what it sounds like was an exceptional source and provenance. But there's plenty of other people offering you materials that you can see whether or not they do something interesting.
Exactly. And I've talked to many people now, both who are currently either in the program or have worked on the program and said this stuff exists. So at a certain point, I mean, again, I don't have my hands on any of this stuff personally, but at a certain point, the number of stories that you get have to be ascribed some level of truth, and that these people who are saying it have no reason to go out of their way to tell a professor at Stanford that this stuff is real, or meet me in a dark corner of a bar to tell me about this stuff. I mean, why do that?
So, and we've heard similar things that again, like I can't serve as primary on, but we've heard similar things that people have shared publicly, even on this podcast.
Yeah. To me, there's enough smoke there that the opportunity risk is low. That, okay, I've, as you said earlier at the beginning, opening the thing, I've achieved everything I ever set out to do in biology in terms of giving the world tools to investigate the immune system in ways they couldn't do before. And that we've produced so much data that now my lab has turned towards artificial intelligence to make meaning of the data, because sort of like humanity always backs itself into a corner and then comes up with something in the nick of time that might be a solution for a time being, but might actually also be a problem. And so there's a whole discussion around AI that you could have around this. But so I'm like, okay, I've done that. I'm going to be 64 years old in a month. To me, spending time on this is the dream of a lifetime. To spend time on something like this and to bring all the lessons I've learned over the last several decades to bear on this. And it's not just about do I succeed or not. It's about providing a model for other people and young people to say, ah, okay, well, that's interesting. And this guy, as you said, has achieved, and he thinks there's something here, and give people the model of how to talk about it. I mean, I spent a lot of time on Twitter in the last several years teaching the community how to ask the questions in a valid way and how not to let the rhetoricians, the people who use rhetoric against them, to back them into a corner. And I think we've turned the tide. And now there's like a cottage industry of organizations that have now sprung up, all of whom have said, we're not going to wait for daddy government to do this for us. We're going to go out and do it ourselves. And some one day.
Which is common in most industries, by the way.
Yeah.
So this idea that we got to look to. And so there are parts of the government that are trying to forward this in a transparent manner and support entrepreneurs for sure. But then I guess this point of, I mean, I think the Space Act 2020 Act says the government shouldn't do what the private sector can do. So just a lot of these things really taking off or starting on that American leadership kicking off in the private sector is certainly the way things roll in many, many industries, not just UAP tech.
Well, I mean, Musk and Bezos each individually said, look, I think there's a way that we can bring capitalism to the space industry. And they've succeeded. And a lot of that was funded by NASA, at least the initial tech. So that's a good thing. I think government should be there to seed the science and then let capitalism take over.
And to that point of capitalism really taking over, though, I mean, so one of the things, I mean, I work with thousands of entrepreneurs across hundreds of companies and networks of hundreds of investors. And so what I'm hearing is there are some, I'm not going to go into naming any names because people don't always want it to be known where what they're diligencing or checking out. But there's some very big names that are pretty serious and pretty into this. And then there's also, when we see this area of conversation amongst innovators and startups, not to say that it's everybody's cup of tea, because there's no field of technology that's going to bring out everybody, but this is by far the highest level of interest we've seen in anything. So we can, if we tell people we want to talk about this, we get like 100 people together in less than a day and a half type thing. So it's on, they're willing to stay on and talk about it for hours at a time. So I have never, my entire career has been in investments and disruptive technologies. I have never seen so much interest and so many high caliber people. So, but you know, in your role at Seoul and your role as a researcher, What are you seeing in terms of that investor interest, that innovator interest? And some people are keeping it a little bit quiet. Some people are still, they're not out, but they're definitely, and sometimes people even put out misinformation while they place their bets, right? Like, nothing to see here, folks. Like, let me have it. This is really dumb. Like, don't develop AI. Like, come on to me, AI company. Go, go, go.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of poker being played. I think Machiavelli would be proud. So, you know, the problem is convincing the right people within the government. And I think we have an opportunity with the new Trump administration, who's going to be very disruptive. Chaos can actually breed opportunity. And so I think that there's an opportunity here, because so many people who are being put into position in the Trump administration have evinced an interest in releasing the information and pulling down the walls, whether it's Musk or Gates or half a dozen other people who've all seen the data behind scenes. Now, I don't think Musk has necessarily, but a lot of the representatives and senators have seen the data behind the scenes, have said, we need to let this stuff out. There's no reason the U.S. population or the American people can't handle this, or the world can't handle it. But I think it behooves the United States, as frankly the leader of the free world, to grab the bull by the horns and run now. Because everybody knows, and let's talk about AI as an example. Everybody knows that the first country that conquers quantum computers or conquers artificial general or artificial superintelligence is going to leap ahead of everybody else so fast that it'll make your head spin. And so, and it's out there. I mean, the government has said it. So imagine if, while we're busy doing that and we're so focused on that and we lose an opportunity for transportation or energy to another country, not only do we lose military advantage, but we lose economic advantage.
I think really breaking that down, Gary, and I don't know how much further we need to go in depth, but just this point that if your most leading edge scientists have thought of something that could lead to value, assume that your most aggressive competitor will do it, assume that your adversaries are doing it, and assume that if we're not managing this, somebody else is. So I think just that burning platform and the what's at risk, what's at stake here, and the talking to people broadly, because everybody in their jobs, this for some people, this has been out of scope. So you've stepped into this, Gary, from a leadership position in bio, but it probably wasn't in your scope of like your job description, you know. But we see it clearly in space technology that it's like, wow, feels like this could be something that could be a major amplifier or a risk to our leading capabilities. So we do not have a luxury to ignore something that could be the source of advantage or lack thereof.
Right.
So I think that burning platform, if there's anything else that you have to say on that, it's important that people hear it, because some of the movers and the shakers aren't in this yet. They haven't yet stepped into addressing this, and those might be the people that get it done.
I think you have to have the courage of your convictions. Several of my technologies, years ago I won the Nature Technology of the Year Award. This year we won it again for Nature Methods. Two of my lab technologies won for spatial biology, different kind of spatial. And we're still publishing in Nature and Cell, et cetera. So you can do both. You don't have to give up your career and your day job to continue to and continue to commit to results and good science in the day job, while still saying to others, there's these other opportunities out there for investment. And just for some of the people that we all know, throwing $10 or $20 million at a problem is pocket change. And so imagine if that pocket change changed the world.
That's right. And I think from the investor side, and one of the reasons, like you're saying, Gary, that I've been able to be so active is that this is based on a portfolio approach. So like you've said, you've seen projects go well. I mean, I've been fortunate to have backed many companies that have kind of grown from that nothing to the leader in category, disruptive solution, unicorn, multi-hundred million, like dozens of them type companies. And so that recognizing that even when something's not what we think it is, but we might build something really valuable, that happens. Mm-hmm. So for instance, if these advanced materials turn out to be terrestrial, if they're exotic and useful, that's highly valuable. Mm-hmm. And then if you've got, my view is keep doing the terrestrial energy, have mm-hmm. your normal energy portfolio, but definitely get some of the, get exposure to some of the things that can be completely disruptive,
right,
whether it's terrestrial or whether it's based on insights for these observables and the UAP related technologies. So in a portfolio, investors have the ability to do this in a portfolio that they know will return as a portfolio. And it's got that amplifying potential to take it another 100x, or maybe you go from your 10x down to 9 or 8x, mm-hmm. and you're still doing very well.
Yeah. I think this whole idea, though, of putting together some sort of a fund of funds to spark an interest in the area, or to say to the government, here are a group of experts who, if you have a material that you don't understand, give it to them. They'll investigate it down to the atomic level and then give that information back to the group as a whole, right? Because we lack still the basic knowledge of what these materials might be and how they're made. It sickens me to hear that there's stuff sitting in boxes in a warehouse out in Nevada. And that if you gave me a gram of that stuff, what I could do with it. And to think that it's just being kept in a, because nobody knows what to do with it. Well, it sounds to me like somebody's just not smart enough.
Yeah. And there are plenty of people who do know what to do with it and you disagree on what to do with it and come up with a wide array of approaches. So there's the most common ones, but just when you have the conversation, it's amazing the level of innovation that can come
through. What would excite the youth of the country than more than this? What would get them into the classes for physics, for math, for STEM, et cetera, more than this? I can't imagine. And there's just nothing.
I want to add something in support of what you said earlier about first material science and having a consortium that has the instruments and the trained people to use them, but also the imagination. And specifically, it was only about 35, 40 years ago that the Swedes caught some bomb residue from a nuclear test. And on the basis of that residue, figured out how a deeply classified device was built.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's because they taught folks at the University of Lund tied a bunch of things together and said, oh, I know what these isotopes mean. I know how this was made.
Right. And yeah, don't underestimate the intelligence of the crowd is really I think the lesson I'd like to leave people with, and understand that you are in a competition with others and who might not have the best interest of the United States at heart.
So Gary, I mean, I think that's a really important point. And you might have some time limitations here, but both appreciative of your work on the advanced material side, also wouldn't want to miss the opportunity to ask you about some, but you're much more of an expert on the, across the field of biology. There's not that many people who, from what you've shared, are actually active in that space. So also that's an opportunity for biological researchers who want to become number two or number three or number one in this space. Mm-hmm. But whether it's discovering things that you think are tied to this, you've also debunked some things, you've gone into health impacts. From your bio expertise, what's shareable in this space?
Well, sure. Well, I mean, my interest in this whole area began with the Atacama mummy, so-called, that somebody claimed might be an extraterrestrial of some kind. And I said, well, I can analyze it for you. Send me a sample. And I showed, along with three other professors and a team of students and postdocs, as well as Roche Informatics, using the technology that I'd sold to Roche, or a group of us had sold to Roche,
And we showed it was human, and we showed what the potential mutations were that caused the way that it looked. The paper was filled with caveats, which is how a good paper should be written, frankly. But we provided the data. And it was the most explosive possibility that it was an extraterrestrial, but we showed it wasn't. So we disappointed some people. I actually became the target of the UAP UFO community. They hated me because I had taken this opportunity off the table. But that's science. But what's fascinating about science is once you've set aside the stuff that's not interesting, what ends up being left on the table is the stuff that is interesting. And so that brings me to the anomalous health incidents that I got involved with when, after publishing the Atacama stuff or being known for the Atacama stuff, people in the government said, okay, well, here's a guy who's willing to think outside the box. Let's bring him this set of patients we have who have these horrific traumas that had been imposed upon them through some sort of effect that ended up being, of the 100 patients we saw, the majority of them ended up being what was later understood to be Havana syndrome.
Yeah.
And so here, because I had analyzed some weird little mummy, I helped bring about an understanding of Havana syndrome. Well, but what was great about what we did was once we'd figured out and classified of the 100 or so patients, the 85 or 90 who looked like they were Havana syndrome, what was left on the table had an increased concentration of people who said that they had seen UAP.
Oh.
Right? And so, and they had some similar symptomologies, but not to the extent that we had found with what we at the time had called interference syndrome, which later became Havana syndrome, because people were being interfered with.
Gary, was the initial sample set then just Havana syndrome folks? And then
it was a bucket of anomalous health incidents that people just said, well, okay, here, just put this in the bucket, keep this file until there's enough of them that a pattern emerged. And once that pattern emerged, we'd already figured out what the symptomologies were. And then suddenly, like a year or so later, out comes the Havana issue with our diplomatic corps, which had the same set of symptomologies. And so we saw them 5-6 years earlier already. So what that helped do was now the Department of Health Services has a booklet out and a path for people who have such anomalous health incidents. They show, here's how you work within the governmental system to address the health issues that you have. Here's who you go to talk to at the VA. Here's this, here's that. So because we did that, we gave an opportunity for people who were otherwise being ignored for their medical treatment, a path to solve it for themselves. And there's a whole booklet now. And Senate Armed Services is involved, Oversight Committee in the House is involved to investigate all of this stuff. So that's an example of once you figure out what it is, you can hand it off to the necessary experts who can now take it further. I'm not involved in the analysis of that anymore because there's plenty of people got their fingers stuck in it, including another very well-known professor at Stanford. But the ones that are remaining are the ones that interest me, because they're the ones who claimed that they saw something. And so that it's what's left on the table that's the most interesting. But scientists often think that when they have 95% of the solution that they can go publish, that's fine. But I'm interested in the 5% that didn't get explained.
And Gary, to that point, I mean, because we've heard some really interesting thing based on your work and that of others on kind of, okay, this proximity to UAPs or some of the related phenomena, such as orb, you can sometimes see this range of health outcomes. The other thing that's interesting to me about this is I've spoken to several people and have experience that some folks do come up in relatively close range without any health impacts that are noticeable to them. So do you have anything that you would share with that portion of the data? Or,
well, all I can say is speculation, and truly I'm not hiding anything. All I can say is speculation. So what that tells you is that there's probably multiple different modes of movement, or that whatever these objects are use different modes of operation. Some emit a field that hurt people. Others don't seem to. What does that tell you? It tells you that there's at least two different ways you can perhaps alter gravity. I don't know. I mean, that's, and so it's just, to me, data. I push this thing all the time. Don't make conclusions.
But have you also seen, as you've spoken to people, you've heard of both, but
yes,
people heard of that are negatively impacted, and then people that say, yeah, I get up close to the orb, take a photo, love it, no big deal.
Well, maybe they turn off their, maybe when they're just moving around it 3 feet an hour or 3 feet a second, that doesn't require the same propulsion system that takes you to 5,000 miles an hour.
Yeah, Hal Potthoff and I had an interesting discussion on this, because you have, as you point out, when things are moving at a very rapid clip, we're always wondering, well, where is the thermal signature? Where is the shockwave? Things like that. And yet when they're down close to the ground, people often get hurt. And Hal's conjecture was that the mechanism may in fact be blue shifting infrared into UV, into soft x-rays, which would explain the burns that people get.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, the skin burns. I've seen people with the skin burns. Yeah. So, I don't know. I think it's, as long as you stay in the realm of, so I mean, this is the other thing I say a lot, and your audience can appreciate this. If I can convince another scientist that the data is real, and was collected by the correct methodology, and is reproducible in some to some level, then that's the beginning of hypothesis generation discussions between scientists. If I come to a conclusion that is reptilians from the Pleiades, immediately out of that, then I can be proven wrong pretty quickly and made to look like an idiot. So the point is, stay close to the data and the methods. And so I would encourage anybody in your audience who's interested in getting into this area is to stay away from the rabbit hole and the conclusions and stay close to collecting more data.
So on that collect more data front, a couple other interesting things that feel free to weigh in or not on is the methods of transport. Some people have seen the flash in as opposed to the zoom kind of move in type thing. So that's one. And then another thing we've been hearing quite a bit about is the transmedium. Yeah. So kind of, so are those areas that you have any interesting observations to share or what you, or any stakes in the ground on any of that?
No, nothing that I can actually share, unfortunately. It's, I mean, there's of course the public discussion of seeing something move. People, there's videos out there with things that move from the water to the air and then back again with no apparent splash. So what does that mean? Does that mean that how do you do that? I mean, how do you move through the air without creating a thermal signature? Does one idea might be that you've shifted yourself into a level of reality that allows you to accomplish that. So this notion of putting cranial warp around yourself takes you out of the universe, and that allows you to move in the universe without affecting the things around you or being affected by the things around you. That's one notion. Sounds spectacular.
And it's okay. I've actually funded some warp bubble work that was previously funded by DARPA. So there are people that are seriously looking at those mechanisms.
And so that's one way of thinking about it, or something which has a field effect which is so immediately influenced or knowledgeable about its environment is that it can flow matter around it, much like a metamaterial flows light around itself. Perhaps there's a way to make a field effect that flows matter around you, right? So a metamaterial for matter rather than a metamaterial for energy, right? And maybe these fields turn the matter immediately into energy, and that's how they basically act as a metamaterial for energy. See what I'm saying? I'm making stuff up as I go along, but that's what that's what creative scientists do. It could be 100% wrong, but at least as long as you have it in your palette of hypotheses, you won't be surprised by a result And you won't take the idea off the table immediately because that idea might be actually the solution that gets you to the goal.
And that is the work, is really, if you're trying to build something concept from de novo, which is often the case. I mean, people are building things from ideas, from inspiration, from science fiction, right? Sometimes ideas come faster to creatives. Or if it's observation, something that's fully operational that we believe exists, what are the various hypotheses or paths to getting there?
Science fiction author for the last 40, 50 years. And there's not an idea that I've heard that I haven't seen represented in some of those books.
Yeah, Doc E. Smith, for example, and his inertialist drive.
Well, then the creative capabilities and tying in the streams of information. I mean, it's nice when it's the same process in the lab as in making a song, but sometimes it's easier to do it in a fiction novel than to do it in the lab when some of the pieces are missing. So that's all really important. I guess with one of the things that drives this, we do have the conversation of what are the unusual things that we should be, as scientists, paying attention to. So Hal kind of does a talk, and he brought it up a couple weeks ago, where it was, all right, and here are the really anomalous things on the left-hand side of the page. And then his right-hand side of the page drives it back to engineering of various physics equations, but not focusing as much on the right-hand side of the page. But when you say, what are the things, I mean, you've shared a number of them, but is there anything else on that? Here's the bullet points on the page that I brought up. We're hearing transmedium travel. You brought up some of the structured materials. What are some of those things on the left-hand side of the this is unusual, pay attention to it side of the page?
Well, the claims of interaction by the consciousness that is represented by whatever these things might be. The notion of how do thoughts appear in people's heads, where they say that sometimes they get some sort of communication from these objects. Okay, so how are the objects affecting the brains of individuals in a meaningful way that represents communication? So what I wonder is, well, what is the advanced technology that somehow can reach inside of a person's head and make sound happen by touching the neurons in a way that sends a signal? So to me, I mean, that's an observable, right? That has been observed or claimed to be observed by people. And that's something that's not on that list of observables.
And that's both with UAPs, and then it's also something that's been observed without UAPs in some other fields of technologies, like perhaps the Stargate program. But separately, one of the things that comes up occasionally is the focus on, and Larry, I'm just blanking on the name, but the one that we always talk about with regards to the microtubules.
Oh, Stuart Hambro. OR consciousness idea. Yeah, I mean, and Penrose is no dummy. Oh, he won the Nobel in quantum physics just a couple of years ago. But he took it from a very basic idea, laid out things that would have to be observed, 15 or so observables that would have to happen for it to be true. And I think people have proven like 8 or 9 of them already. And so we live in a stranger universe than people want. People want this conservative view of how the universe operates because it's comfortable that way. And I'm very uncomfortable with comfortable.
And there's a start, that's a choice. So this is really, we're at a fork in the road right now where there's no reason that we need to stay on a more evolutionary path. I mean, there are some things to be managed through, but the point that there's a lot of things that aren't being run to ground right now based on, that's a lot potentially for one individual's pocketbook and in terms of an average American, but you know, simple things like equipment, information sharing, centralization, just the ability to go after things on more of a portfolio approach where, I mean, one of the things that we say that makes America great is the ability to, and you're in California, the ability to fail fast, right? The ability to iterate and get to greatness, both through success, but also through working things that not everything needs to hit it big. But when you're not taking those shot on goals, they're not going into the net. So there's a total the amount of capital that is available and not deployed right now. Well, there's the amount of talent that hasn't been freed up to work on this or isn't engaged. We could see a total step change if people choose to go down that path.
Well, I hope that Congress, under the new administration, now that it's a united administration, uses a crowbar to wedge open some of these boxes and then puts the necessary resources behind it to enable understanding. I mean, for at least two reasons. One, if it's all a big bag of hot air, let's just take it off the table. Just release the necessary information or say the reason why it is that we can't release whatever it is it's not ET, it's not aliens, it's not non-human intelligence. It's something we're doing. Okay, tell me that with finality in a manner that I can believe. And then I'll go away. And people like me will go away. But until they do that, and since they're not doing that, they're basically, they're acting like the kid who got stuck with their hand in the cookie jar. And they look so guilty that you want to spank them. I mean, I'm sorry if I'm putting it into all of these kinds of verbiage, but that's what upsets me so much.
And to your point, I mean, it's so interesting, the origin. So sure, there is a question of, is this on planet, off planet, or what is it? But if we can also just step away from that part of the question and say, many people are saying their materials, their technologies, their performance that has these witnesses, these types of data on it. And so if there's a more advanced technology, regardless of where it's from, there's something more, right? Yeah. And so then do we say, well, this is constrained? Like the way, that's fine. We have things that not everybody has access to, like nuclear weapons. So it's like you have them. It's not that you use them or that everybody gets to do that. But if there are more advanced capabilities that can have beneficial uses, there's a technology side, regardless of origin, that should be of interest to people. Just if there is an application, regardless of where it's from.
I'd like to just end with this because I do actually have to go back to that notion I said of, is the question, are they here or can they get here? The other question is, have they always been here? Because they got here so long ago. That the question of are they from somewhere else is meaningless, because maybe they've been here longer than we have, and they have more right to claim that the planet is theirs than we do. We're latecomers to the party. The universe has been around for 15 billion years, plenty of time for something to get here, even by relatively conventional means. And so I think that if we could pull back and inspire people's wonder about those questions, then that will inspire them to go the next step and get involved. And to me, that is really where I think scientists have to serve two purposes. One is to be the person who does the work, but the other is to inspire interest in the community and to do it in a way that looks like it is serving the community and not serving themselves.
And to your point on whether things have been here before, I mean, I guess regardless of the answer to that, if we ask people, is there intelligent life on other planets? We're going to Mars. We're going to Mars, and we're going back to the moon. So we will, as a civilization, if we make the investments and if we do the work, we will be putting humanity on other planets. And that's not just going to be the U.S. government. It's going to be the private sector. And of course, we're going to be going with international partners as well, with Artemis and others. But the question is not intelligent life on another planet. That is happening. So let's get there. So in terms of our own civilization going out and if others are coming in, we need to work through that.
Mm-hmm. I'll let you have the last word.
Well, thanks so much, Gary. Diane, I know you like to close out as the real hostess of all of this.
This has been an inspiring conversation. And really to our listeners, thank you again for joining us today. Please, if you enjoy this, do check out the season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models and how these convergences are reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. So follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts and your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushandworks.com. Thank you again.